It's Wednesday, November 24, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The attention of the world is directed at the Korean Peninsula, where yesterday's attack by North Korea on an inhabited South Korean island has led to an international crisis. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon described the attack as the most provocative event since the end of open hostilities over 50 years ago in what has been called the Korean War. We are reminded, of course, that the Korean War did not end with a surrender or with an official armistice. According to all of the partisans and belligerents, it still is a war, and that is why there are so many hundreds of thousands of troops that are mobilized together in that very thin spot of land known as the Demilitarized Zone. So much is at stake here, of course, with South Korea's population, approximately 70%, being within the distance of an artillery barrage or at least a long-term rocket attack from North Korea. An all-out attack from North Korea, which is absolutely armed to the teeth and run by a totalitarian regime, would lead to massive and unthinkable casualties on both sides, but particularly on the part of South Korea. South Korea is in a very difficult position here. It is covered by the shield of American protection under treaty, and there are approximately 200,000 American troops in the area. President Barack Obama announced that he is sending a carrier task force into the region. That's a very powerful symbol of U.S. power. But when it comes down to what's going to happen over the next several days, no one knows. There is an obvious leadership transition going on in North Korea and in the paranoid circles of the Hermit Kingdom, but no one is able to read that mind. We do know that Russia and China are both alarmed, and that's good news. But can North Korea be tamed or contained? That, sadly, remains to be seen. The people of Great Britain have had quite a wake-up call in recent days, as news reports indicate that a network of more than 40 part-time Islamic schools and clubs in the British schools with 5,000 students have been teaching a curriculum from the Saudi Arabian government that contains Sharia law, outright statements of anti-Semitism, and claims that, for example, homosexuals should be executed. Now, what we face in this particular development in Great Britain is the encroachment of an Islamicist culture and the ambition to spread that culture through means of educating the young, especially boys, in what in the Islamic world would be called a madrasa, but in Great Britain turns out to be the public schools. Now, as is reported by John Burns in the New York Times, one of the textbooks in this program, according to the BBC, prescribed execution as the penalty for gay sex, outlined differing viewpoints as to whether death should be by stoning, immolation by fire, or throwing offenders off a cliff. Another set out the punishments prescribed by Sharia law for theft, including amputation of the hands and feet. I remind you that this is being taught to school children in Great Britain. The program also reveals outright statements of anti-Semitism, including statements about the reprehensible qualities of the Jews that students are now required in this program to learn and to be able to recite in a test. The British people have registered a good deal of shock about this discovery, and for good reason. This is an intrusion of Sharia law and Islamicist philosophy into the lives of British school children. Now, they are the children of Islamic parents, but this is still being taught in the British public schools. Interestingly, the funding source for this program is the Saudi Arabian government. We should be reminded that that is the government that has been paying for the export of Wahhabism, that is the very dangerous ideological form of Islam that has affected groups ranging from Al-Qaeda to the Taliban and beyond. The Wahhabist movement believes that the West is inherently decadent and must be replaced by a strong civilization, the civilization of Islam under Sharia law. Looking at another issue of great controversy in the news, there is all kinds of attention to statements made by Pope Benedict XVI concerning the possible moral use of a condom under certain very tightly conscribed circumstances. Now, you would think that the Pope had set forth an encyclical on condom use, but that is hardly the case. Instead, what happened is that the Pope gave an extended book-length interview, and as that book has been published by Ignatius Press, there have been those who have quickly noted that the Pope addresses the issue of condom use, suggesting that it might be appropriate and even moral to use a condom under certain circumstances that would prevent harm done to another. This is not a change in the Vatican's position on birth control in general or the condom specifically, but it is an open statement by the Pope that is deeply rooted in Catholic moral theory and the principle of subsidiarity. This has to do with the fact that there are primary and secondary moral causes and motivations, and the primary cause can never be what would be accomplished by a condom, but the secondary cause might well be in light of the first. Now, if that sounds confusing, it has to do with some of the technicalities of Catholic moral reasoning, but there is an evangelical parallel to this that comes readily to mind. It is not our evangelical belief that sinners must compound their sin in every way possible. One of the ways a sexual sinner committing an act of adultery or transacting business with a prostitute or something similar can compound his sin is by using it also as an opportunity by neglect to share the infection of HIV or a similar disease. Now, the interesting thing to note in all of this is not that the Pope made this statement, but that the media has made so much of it. This is not an innovation in truth in the way the Vatican has approached the question, though it is a more explicit statement as related to the use of condoms than the Vatican has ever issued thus far. But more interesting to me is what's going on in the media, where there is a frenzy to try to find some authorization for the use of a condom that goes far beyond what the Pope had intended here. From an evangelical perspective, this just underlines again and again the fact that there is this great quest for moral authorization on the part of a fallen culture, on the part of sinful people who seek authorization for their sin. It's very easy in this case to detect it, as we see the media frenzy about this and all the cultural conversation. But in reality, if we're honest with ourselves, every sinner, ourselves included, naturally seeks an authorization for our sin. That is the one thing Scripture does not allow. No, it's not your imagination. The commercialization of the season is well underway. Amy Zimmerman of the Wall Street Journal reports that something new is afoot this year. Black Friday, it turns out, that is the day after Thanksgiving, is not really going to be the inaugural rush of the Christmas season. No, that's going to take place on Thanksgiving Day. Now, much of the activity will take place online, but not all of it. As she reports, a good many retailers are deciding to open for at least some hours on Thursday, on Thanksgiving Day. She writes, for the first time, Sears is opening on Thursday from 7 a.m. until noon, joined this year by stores such as the Old Navy that is owned by The Gap Incorporated. Now, I thought this was something entirely new, but Amy Zimmerman makes clear that there have been some retailers who have already been opening on Thursday. Those stores, by the way, have included Kmart, the Sports Authority, and Big Lots. And yet, even stores that are not opening on Thanksgiving are pushing a lot of business online. Stephanie Clifford, writing at the New York Times, suggests that even before Friday's crush of retail business, many deals will go online. Kevin Mansell, who is the chairman and chief executive of Kohl's, says it's going to be a very competitive day. Kohl's, by the way, has more than 1,000 outlets nationwide, but it's going to offer almost all of its Black Friday specials online beginning on Thanksgiving Day. I mentioned this not so much to bemoan the commercialization of the Christmas season, that's a different issue, but rather to point to the fact that it's becoming more and more difficult for this nation to celebrate any holiday without the intrusions of retail traffic. The internet is part of it. After all, it's a 24/7 circus of commercialization. But beyond that, now you have stores and malls opening on Thanksgiving Day as well. Now, when it comes to a celebration like Thanksgiving, associated with family, and by the way, we are told by transportation authorities that there will be more travel on the part of family members meeting other family members on Thanksgiving than even during the Christmas season. But it is becoming very difficult. The more stores and malls that are open, the more business that is directed towards Thursday, the greater the difficulty of families to gather on this day. We should note that something is lost when the nation cannot even pause for a single day during the year for a Thanksgiving celebration. This has something to do, I think, with the secularization of the larger culture. I really think there's no way to get around this. This has to do with the commercialization of Christmas, yes, but also what we would now have to describe is the commercialization of Thanksgiving Day as well. Speaking of Thanksgiving Day and giving thanks, I'm reminded that Robert Putnam and David Campbell, in their recent book, American Grace, point to what they call a grace gap in the American culture. It turns out that Americans are divided over the issue of saying grace at meals. They are divided into three basic groups: those who almost always thank God for a meal, those who virtually never thank God for a meal, and those, a much smaller group in the middle, who sometimes thank God for a meal. Now, one of the interesting things they document is that you can make an almost absolute political equation between those who identify with Republicans and Democrats over the issue of the grace gap. They go so far as to argue that if you can find out if an individual says grace over meals, you'll actually be able to determine, almost assuredly, their party affiliation. I mention that not for the partisan interest, but for the affirmation that, once again, worldviews matter. And it is a worldview that brings us to the issue of giving thanks. Thanksgiving is not just a secular affirmation. One gives thanks because one believes that there is a cause for thankfulness, and even more importantly, there is one to whom we should be thankful. That's the great quandary of a secularist Thanksgiving. How does one who does not believe in God, and therefore does not believe in a benevolent Father who gives us all of these things, especially as Christians believe, centered in the riches that are given us in Christ, but, as Jesus himself reminded us, even to be thankful for our daily bread, if one does not have a God in whom one believes, if one's worldview is basically agnostic or atheist or secular, how is it that one would have any motivation to be thankful? It's hard to believe that anyone can be thankful over against a blind cosmos, or over against the blackness of space. The secularist worldview, like every other worldview, has consequences. And it turns out that one of those consequences is what would have to be described even minimally as an awkwardness when it comes to giving thanks. Christians, on the other hand, should be reminded that when we are participating in Thanksgiving, not only on Thanksgiving Day, but on any other day, it's not that we should go through the motions of giving thanks just so that we can know that we have done it. It is to examine our hearts to make certain that we are truly thankful for what God has given us in the past, gives us now in the present, and has promised us in the future. Perhaps it is good that we be reminded of our pilgrim forefathers and foremothers who arrived on these shores in the year 1620. As is chronicled by Nathaniel Morton, citing William Bradford, the governor, these colonists arrived with very little but their hopes and fears, and, of course, their faith in God. As Morton writes, "Being now past the vast ocean, and a sea of troubles before them and expectations, they had now no friends to welcome them, no inns to entertain or refresh them, no houses or much less towns to repair unto to seek for succor, and for the season it was winter. And they that knew the winters of the country knew them to be sharp and violent, subject to cruel and fierce storms, dangerous to travel to known places, much more to search unknown coasts." End quote. Well, just imagine our situation today, and how much greater is our cause to be thankful. Happy Thanksgiving to you and your family. I pray that each of you will have a marvelous and deeply meaningful Thanksgiving celebration. I look forward to meeting you once again for the briefing on the Monday following Thanksgiving. Thanks for listening to The Briefing.